Oh, I can open the bell.
Well, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, FASB, at both ends of the Atlantic. Andrea, you're going to start first and hand over.
Yes, to the sessions today and tomorrow, we've got three main topics. One is on the residual margin, whether or how to unlock it. We're going to talk about a presentation, in particular the summarised margin approach and how we could get volume information onto the face of the financials of the statement of comprehensive income. And also we're going to be talking about acquisition costs and asking the boards to reconsider their previous decisions and decide whether or not they want to confirm or modify or do something else with the acquisition costs. So, Sandra.
So good morning, everyone, and thank you very much for being here. It's an absolute pleasure now to discuss the residual margin at the decision time here. We've been talking about the residual margin since, I think, January, and we had a few decisions on it in February where we decided that we wouldn't allow for day one gains, so that means we will have a residual margin in the risk adjustment model. We also had some decisions on acquisition costs and overheads, like what cash flows to include in the measurement of the insurance contract, and it also affects the size, the value of the residual margin. So we have three papers today. It's the whether to unlock, the how to unlock, and the allocation of the remainder. So I think you need to look at those papers together, because the decision of whether you want to unlock should be determined or affected by your decision of how you want to unlock. Okay. First of all, let's start, what is the residual margin? We heard that a lot. It's the difference between the expected cash in and cash outflows plus the risk adjustment. So what does that mean? It will cover some kind of overhead, some unspecified uncertainties and stuff that you want to price in into your premium. But essentially, it's also expected profit. What did the ED say? So we had in the whether to unlock paper, you have an appendix that shows the basis for conclusions in the ED. So what the ED did is you calculate your residual margin on day one, you look at, and on inception, what are your expected cash in, cash outflows. You have that residual margin calculated, you freeze that expected profit amount, and you just run it off. Now, over passage of time, or maybe a different pattern if it better reflects claim benefits payment. So this expected profitability that is reflected in the residual margin would not be updated, and it would not change if the other building blocks are changing. And all the changes in the building blocks would immediately hit the P&L. So that's the EV. So you heard that a lot from me, the feedback from our comment letters, from outreach, from the feedback received from the working group members, from our field test participants. They all said, well, the residual margin should be unlocked. It doesn't mean that actual experience, so you had to pay out more in that period, that shouldn't affect residual margin. That should just immediately go to P&L. Okay, so what are the reasons why not to unlock? If you would allow for day one gain, it would be only consistent and all the other changes go immediately to P&L. That would be consistent. Some say, and I think we heard that in previous board meetings too, that the residual margin needs to cover some overheads and some additional costs. And if you adjust the residual margin, there might not be anything left when you need it for those overheads that will just come when they come. And some would say it also introduces a further level of complexity because you need to track your adjusted residual margin. So why does the staff recommend to unlock the residual margin? We want to unlock it for changes in estimates. So again, not for actual, for current experience you had in the contract, but for changes in estimates. Because we want to be consistent with what we're doing at day one. If you have estimates, they would change the residual margin, so we want to do exactly the same thing here. We want to adjust the residual margin if, well, you need to adjust your expected profitability because you had changes in your estimates in the other building blocks. And what we don't want to see is that we have a loss or a gain in one period And we already know that it affects the expected profitability for the next future periods, and we wouldn't see that. We would just see the immediate hit, but we wouldn't see the adjustment to that. So that would bring us to the question already on page 10. I'm happy to take your comments, questions.
Before we open up, perhaps I think Jennifer would like to see
another one. Yeah. Well, I guess, do we want to take it all together, or?
We're going to do the weather first.
Okay. I guess in general, some of the comments that we'd make would really cover all three papers. I think Sandra said, you know, you can't really just look at whether to unlock without how to unlock and what to unlock. And so some of the concerns really relate to the unlocking. If we're just focusing on the one paper of unlocking, then the question is, are we really taking a step back in certain jurisdictions where we do see changes in estimates flowing through the income statement today? And one of the biggest things we've heard and the problems and why the IASB did not go with FAS 60 was because of the locked-in assumptions on certain types of the life contracts. And so this, if we're unlocking the residual margin, you basically are locking in the results in the income statement. And so you'd show it, presumably, in the footnotes, the unlocking. But you wouldn't be seeing that in the income statement. And today, for certain types of contracts, investment-type contracts, at least in the U.S., it's all unlocked, anyways, through the income statement. It happens to be through one line item of change in deferred acquisition costs the way that it happens. But the change in estimates are ran through the income statement today. And also on the property casualty, the change in estimates are ran through the income statement today. So this would be, and also in other jurisdictions in Canada and other places, so this would be saying my changes in my estimates will not run through the income statement. Instead, it'll run through the residual margin, which basically is taking what today in some jurisdiction is a change in liability item in the income statement and moving that to the balance sheet and having the residual margin essentially act as a change in liability. So while there's arguments for unlocking certain components, and I guess we'll get into that in the next papers, I think it would be difficult to say for all of the items to unlock it, make it less transparent, and you wouldn't really see the true economics of the underlying business.
But just maybe to add to that, if we look at Canada, for example, they do have a day one gain.
Right.
So it would be only consistent doing that. Not locking because you have no residual margin. If you have no day one gain, you have no residual margin.
That's a good
point. And you're saying, Jennifer, that in the U.S. you don't unlock any margins, you just let it run through the P&L. Is that what you're saying?
So for the one big thing is, for property casualty or for non-life business and then also for those types of contracts that are accounted for as investment-type contracts, the changes do run through the P&L. So it's just for certain types of traditional life insurance contracts that we don't update the assumptions. And the biggest thing that we've heard from users, biggest reason to change US GAAP is because they want to see those assumptions updated. And so now what we'd be doing is essentially locking in those assumptions through the P&L and just offsetting it in one line item on the balance sheet. And so is that really an improvement over what we currently have, and are we taking a step back in even other jurisdictions, not just the U.S., for where that might happen?
Okay, thank you. Tatsumi, I think you were first.
So I have a question on page 10, paragraph 31B. The last sentence of the 31B, you characterized the sort of the residual margin as a sort of the it represents the current assessment of the expected profitability of the contract. So this notion is very new to me, because previously we just talking about this residual margin as a plug, or say to avoid a day one gain. So we invented this kind of notion. But now you characterize this as to show the sort of the profitability of the contract. I'm not quite sure that if we can define in this way. It's very beautiful, but I'm a little bit cautious about the characterization of this one, because they say at the inception there are several, say just a sort of the cash outflows related to the building blocks covers the fulfillment of the contract. But say some other things, providing service or such kind of things, is, it seems to me, included in the residual margin. But say just, but you characterize this as a profitability of the contract. So what really do you mean by this?
Well, of course, we've seen that in the appendix, for example, what we see that the residual margin is not just one thing. If it would be that case, it would be, we would be able to remeasure it maybe even. So it is a bundle of many things. But all this wants to show is that, amongst others, it is the expected profitability, the expected profit that, well, the profit you want expect from that contract. Because the plug, as you say, is the difference between the expected cash outflows and the expected cash inflows, the premiums, plus the risk adjustment. So that should be what you think, what you expect.
Yeah, because there's some of the, say, risk margin covers the overheads cost or some claim handling service. Claim handling must be part of the building blocks, but some other, say, related service might be here. So the notion of the profitability is sort of the directly related to the, after deducting the directly fulfilling the, say, insurance contract, then you call it a profitability. Mm-hmm. Is that your definition of this line of thinking?
I think on day one, what you have is you have the premium, which you know is going to cover, amongst other things, what it costs you to fulfill the obligation and what you bear for the risk and the profit that you expect in the contract. And that if you get the other building blocks right, what you expect to get is profit, ought to dominate the residual margin. On day two, if you regard it as a plug and allocate it off, then it doesn't represent that anymore. It represents an allocation of the residual margin to make sure it's recognized somehow in profit or loss along some pattern that isn't too wrong. What we're seeing, and the comment letters told us that most people do see this as the expected profitability of the contract, and what we're seeing is that if you have changes in estimates of what that profitability is, then if you allow that to adjust the residual margin, then you have, it's almost like you assign meaning to what the residual margin represents in day two, day three, and onwards.
Yeah, so you were just talking about unlocking. And the subsequent measurement of this profitability is, say, I have a contract 10 years ago, but this contract, due to the change in non-fulfillment factors, it changes. So to show that current status is better than having the, say, amortized day one residual margin, I would like to be persuaded, but still the, say, such a notion of the profitability is of the, say, my current contract is sort of current value of the profitability. Yeah, still I try to understand the meaning, but it's a new concept. I haven't digested it yet.
Okay, Tatsu, mate, you better have a session at lunchtime then, getting short.
It's because you didn't come to our small groups.
Sorry? No. I understand, but say, characterizing, it's a showing the profitability is a very new notion to me. I try to understand the implication of this new characterization.
But can I ask you a question, Tatsumi? Did you accept that was what the day one representation was before in the exposure draft, or did you not see the residual margin as some measure of future profit in the exposure draft?
No. Once having this notion, I think this is a good understanding. So that I try to be positive.
And this is the best you can do.
Okay, we better give other people a chance. PK?
The one thing I want to ask is that
I do appreciate the 31B talks about profitability. I don't know I'm fully bought into that theory completely because it's not full profitability for me. But before I get my emotions high on this whole 3B, 3C, and 3D, I want to ask a question. There has been a substantial shift in my mind about the residual margin from the exposure draft time frame. We have definitely added acquisition cost, both profitable, both successful and unsuccessful acquisition cost. Everything we add into that will chip into residual margin. We have also added other direct cost overhead, direct overheads to be part of the thing. With all that being added on to the estimates and all that stuff, how big is the residual margin going to be left to get our emotions high here? Any indication you can give? I appreciate property and casualty. The risk margin can be different from the life, and I appreciate all that notion, but I just want to get before my emotions high. You know, I want to keep my emotions for David's farewell.
Well, PK, of course, you described it absolutely correctly, that those decisions had a huge impact on the size of the residual margin. Especially because what we heard in the comment letters and the feedback received is that most people thought in the ED that the residual margin is basically overheads and acquisition costs that are, well, not incremental. So it of course, has an important effect how much that is. I'm not sure. But if we think about it as the expected profitability, I think it's still an important value that you should look at.
I mean, if you were to take a step back and you think what people are pricing for, so it's come down, but you know, in the past where they might price for a 15% ROE, it's probably much lower than that today, and you take out, well, okay, my investment income is, you know, used to be maybe whatever percentage, you know, in the past 8% of that, so you know, there's pricing for probably in the underlying contract itself a profit per se of some amount that, you know, could be 10% or something. So I think it still could be a significant amount, but it all depends on where we are in the economic environment, too, of what they're getting.
Ross, were you trying to come in?
I thought these moments were very helpful to understand the theory between locking and unlocking. And what I was trying to figure out in the presentation memo, was the presentation memo assuming locking or unlocking? And if it's unlocking, how do you differentiate and where do you put on the face of the income statement the changes in assumptions versus the changes in the residual margin? Or is that not something you're planning on putting on the face of the income statement?
Well, I think there are two ways you can do it. You can do it as a roll forward in the disclosures, or you could show it in the income statement, but it would be netted.
Or you could gross.
Yeah, exactly. Like you show it gross or you have it as roll forward and disclosure. So the presentation paper, I think you could do both.
You can still have the same line items, but it wasn't contemplating the unlocking, but I think you'd still have.
So it contemplates that the board's concludes locking?
It could be either way, yeah. It did not take into effect the unlocking, the change in assumptions. I think what your point is, Russ, is that we've got a change in assumption line, where the change in assumption line, if you locked in, would be significant, could be significant mm-hmm. each period. Now the only thing that would go there is you'd still have that line item. It'd be change in assumptions in excess of the residual margin. So it would just need to be altered a little bit of what that line item would represent.
Okay, Warren.
Well, there's no doubt that what's in that residual margin is an amalgam of things. I think the staff pointed that fact. I think what you'd say, David, is it's like a haggis. If you knew what was in it, you wouldn't touch it with a 40-foot barge pole. I think I've heard you say that once or twice. And I think that's probably where I've ended up. When we developed the ED, I was one of those that supported unlocking, because I saw it as just being an amalgam of things, and however you run it off, it would be arbitrary. And I couldn't see why then you would want to delay recognition of profit that's embedded in that, particularly if you had adverse developments or adverse experience. Having thought about it a bit longer, though, I must say it worries me, it's a point you made, Jennifer, it worries me that we're including those, whatever they are, experience adjustments, changes in estimates, whatever, maybe changes in effective, changes in discount rates, and so on, in the change in the liability, and they're not being shown transparently in the income statement. Yes, you could deal with that through grossing up, but it seems to me that's the second best answer, and that I think it's far more transparent to show the effects of the changes in estimates, experience adjustments, and so on, in the period in which they arise. And so that's one reason why I've changed my mind. I don't think you should unlock. And the second reason is I think it just adds further complexity to the model. And one of the things I think we were trying to do in developing a new insurance accounting model was to make it less complex, more understandable, and more reflective, I think, of the insurance business that you're trying to capture with the accounting standard. So for those two main reasons, I've changed my mind, and I think we shouldn't unlock, and we should just run it off in some simple pattern, straight line, maybe.
Okay, thank you. Darnell?
I guess at the outset, for me, the question of whether this is a profit or something else is quite important, because I think the context of what happens when residual margin goes down to zero becomes quite important. Are you comfortable for this to be zero for the remainder of its life? It's semantics, but I would probably not call it profitability, I'd call it contribution. It's the contribution that a particular group of contracts is making once it has satisfied all its own cash flows and its own risk. It's the remaining contribution that's left that it then plows into the insurance company to cover overheads and things that are not related. In that context, I'm comfortable that a group of contracts can, in fact, go through the remainder of their life, making no further contribution to the overall running of the company, but still looking after themselves, paying for their own risk and the like. When we started out with this, I was inclined to say you lock. And the reason that I was inclined to say that was because my perception or my feeling through accounting process has been that if there is a change in the market, if there's a change in an indicator, that indicator needs to be reflected in the income statement in the period in which it happens. And that's what you want to see. I have started to change my mind. I've started to be persuaded to go the other way. And largely it's because my understanding is that most of the changes that happen in this place are actually related to changes in long-term estimates. It's not a change that relates right now to this period, and it's not a change because of something that happened in this period. It's merely that during the course of this period, my knowledge about what's going to happen in the future has been expanded or has got better for some reason. Because of that, I'm more inclined to believe that it's right that the effect should be not in the income statement now, but in the income statement over the period that you expect the change to happen, the change in estimate relates to. And so, in the end, support, I mean.
Do you prefer life and PNC, or even life? Because PNC doesn't have long-term.
So certainly for life. I would probably think slightly differently about PNC, but certainly for life.
Okay, now I don't know if it's Darrell.
Hello, Darrell.
Regardless the project, it seems like any time we consider a proposal that adds complexity, preparers almost universally oppose it. Yet, if I understand the paper in this case, on the unlocking, which would add complexity, preparers are in favor of it. And maybe it's my former auditor skepticism coming into play here, but it's very curious to me. Can you explain to us why you think they're in favor of it?
Well, my feeling would be is that some of the counterintuitive effects that we have pointed out in the paragraphs is you would show a loss in one period, but you already know that you have something, you will show a profit next year because you released residual margin. So you would need to explain effects that happen in this period, but they actually are changing the expected profitability, the estimates about the future, and you would need to show that effect today, but it doesn't really belong to that period. So they would say it's a better matching, I would call it, if you adjust the residual margin for it.
And to add to Sandra's point, I think when we talk about complexity, there's two aspects. There's the complexity of doing it, and there's the complexity of what the liability you measure at the end of the day represents. If you accept that the residual margin represents a measure of expected profitability in the future, then what you have is a liability that represents what you're going to have to pay and the expected profit yet to come. If you lock it in and you still have a liability which represents what you're going to pay out, but that residual margin no longer represents anything, and explaining that adds a different sort of complexity to the complexity of doing it.
So, did you want to come in?
I've always thought of the complexity issue. If you like the answer, we're willing to do it. If you hate the answer, it's hugely complex. I thought we started this with the view that is this a way to get the residual composite a little closer? And clearly it's not doing that. And I question what we're trying to accomplish here. I'm a little concerned with, I don't know if we're going to talk about these papers separately or what, but there's, to me, there's operational issues. I see in paper 3C where you're talking about reversing and reinstating, and then further down you're recommending prospective because you can't go back, and those two seem inconsistent. It also seemed to me that when you talked about eliminating a mismatch, two things came to mind. One, it's permitted. And so then I would ask all kinds of questions as to, do I do some of it? Do I do all of it? Is it for a period of time, discrete periods, on and off? And then I would take PK's point that given everything that we seem to be putting in there, if the concern is reducing volatility in earnings, I don't think this is going to work. So I'm just skeptical given what I perceive as a lot of operational issues.
Okay. One point on just on getting the composite margin and risk and residual closer. So when I made my comments, if residual was unlocked downwards, so you don't have profit sitting out there, and you showed, though, the fact that it was unlocked downwards, not upwards, and if it was over sort of the coverage, well, the settlement period for non-life and the coverage period for life, because basically you've got no difference between, we are closer on the composite margin and the residual, the composite and risk residual. In that situation. So, but if it's being unlocked, and that's why it's hard to talk about them all separate, if it's being unlocked, including the discount rate and up and down, then we do have a bigger difference.
But that's the way
it works. Yeah. So, sorry, just wanted to.
Okay, is it Tom Philippe?
I don't understand how unlocking works with the model that is a two margin model. I've been convinced that the reason why the ISB strongly supports a two-margin approach is first they want to you want to measure a liability cost to fulfill the insurance contract that includes a risk margin. That's part of the measurement of the liability. It's not primarily deferred profit. And then you add on a residual margin for the so that you don't have a day one gain, and a remit represents deferral of profit on costs that are mostly not in the fulfillment costs. They're the other costs, overhead, other sorts of items. That's why I don't necessarily agree with your acquisition cost decision, but it's mostly not insurance costs. It's mostly not fulfillment costs that profit's covering. So you have two distinct goals in this model. So if you want to measure the liability correctly, and you say you want to remeasure the risk margin to measure it correctly, it seems you have to remeasure the costs and put it through income to fully remeasure the liability the same. And if that's not happening, what's happening is you remeasure the costs and blend it into the profits on the residual margin. It seems like you're blending the two concepts. You're taking profit on you're making the liability risk margin profit cost related blended into the service margin costs. And I don't understand how that really works together. It sort of it blends the concepts and overrides what I think you're trying to achieve in the model. So I don't see how you can unlock. And I think it's going to exacerbate any ability to asset liability match. Because this approach says part of the liability we measure, risk margin through income, part of the liability, the cost to fulfill when we measure, buffer it into the residual margin. If you don't remeasure the whole liability, there's no hope to match it against changes in assets if you're only remeasuring a part. So I'm having a very hard time understanding how this unlocking fits into the model and the concepts behind the model that you've been developing.
Can I just quickly, because Tom, I think that's an extremely good point, because yes, we know this project is about measuring the liability correctly. The only problems we're facing is that it's the business of those companies. So it's not just measuring liability, they have to have a profit from the. This is how they make their money. So this is the major problem. So what we're doing with unlocking the residual margin is the building blocks are correct. So it's the current cash flows estimates, it's the current risk adjustment, it's the current discount rate. But those change because you still have that buffer from that expected profitability, or however you want to call it, and you adjust it first of all against that to show that this expected profitability has changed.
But see, I think you're overriding this liability measurement when you're doing this, because you're then saying that moves more to a composite margin approach where there is profit both in the insurance component and the residual component, and you're worried about profit. So unlocking says you're worried about profit, where I thought the two margin approach was not to worry about profit on the cost of fulfillment risk margin, it was about measurement of the liability, not about profit. And now you're saying let's worry about profit too, and I think that just convolutes everything.
I think the reality is that we had to start worrying about profit when we decided not to have any D1 gains. We had to start worrying about profit when we decided not to have any D1 gains. If it was just pure liability measurement, you would take the D1 gain. So the fact that there is a residual margin at all says it's not, that there is something else, and we need to deal with that something else and make that something else as meaningful as we can make it.
Okay. If we reverse and say, let's take D1 gains,
then I would say
we still have a big issue here in terms of.
No, we have no residual margin to unlock. If we had no D1 gains, we would have no residual margin to unlock.
I would change. I'd go for the D1 gain because I don't think that would solve it. I would. I absolutely would.
We still have to solve the how to do it, but I favor the proposal from staff, and. I fully agree with the explanation by Daryl and the staff. I think through this process, we not change our objective to faithfully represent the liability. Now, one thing I slightly confused, Tom, you mentioned several times, not only today, in the past, you also mentioned, liability include the residual margin.
The risk margin.
Include the risk margin, not include the residual margin.
Hmm?
I'm right?
I think that's the basis behind your model, yes.
Yeah, but you just said, residual margin is also part of the liability. I'm right?
The residual margin happens to be measured and included in your liability, so you don't have a D1 gain, but it's not really part of your pure liability.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, yes. So I think, we not change, as Sandra just said, we still try to accurately reflect the liability, include risk adjustment, but at the same time, make the residual margin relatively more meaningful than unlocked. Than locked. Yeah, I agree with.
Okay, Pat, welcome back.
Thank you. I think I'm being persuaded that the residual margin should be unlocked. I find the staff's arguments in paragraph 22, particularly 22B, very persuasive. As Andrea said, this problem was created because we didn't want to recognize day one gains. And if we were recognizing that day one gain, then I wouldn't unlock the margin. I'd let the changes in estimates go through P&L, just as you would for any current value estimate. But we're not doing a current value estimate by deferring that day one gain. I think, in a sense, this is going to be confusing to explain to users. I agree with the staff statement that this is confusing to explain to users when you have a loss, when you're recognizing a loss this period, but you're going to continue having this gain that was created at inception, but you wouldn't let them recognize. To me, it's like trying to explain to them why you have a loss on a bond today when interest rates change, even if they're going to hold it to maturity, and that's going to reverse in the future. That's very difficult for them to understand. That's why they often object to having bonds carried at fair value because of that. So this is a similar thing to me. I agree that the changes in estimates are important information for users, and it is something that they have wanted to see and understand. But there's lots of information that's important to users that doesn't end up on the face of the income statement. So there are ways to provide them with that information without running it through P&L. There's lots of stuff that's important. We can't get it all on the face. We acknowledge that every time we talk about presentation. So I'm inclined to support this staff recommendation and unlock the residual.
Got Steve, Elka, Leslie, Daryl, you in again or no? Okay, and then Amaro. So Steve.
Thanks, David. I disagree with the staff. I don't think we should unlock. So Tom and Warren, I've said a lot of what I was going to say, so I won't repeat that. But I agree with their comments. I also agree with what Jennifer said, that effectively, if you unlock the change in assumptions, you are, in effect, locking in the assumptions on day one. It takes us right the way back to really, you know, what we're trying to avoid, I thought. And that is that we had a system that unlocked, reflected changes in circumstances. Because all you end up with is an income statement and a balance sheet that reflects locked-in day one assumptions apart from a situation where you have an onerous contract, which is what we have at the moment. I thought the whole point of the model was to reflect changes in circumstances in a transparent and timely manner, and I think unlocking just doesn't achieve that. So I question what we would really have achieved with this project if we were to unlock the changes in assumptions. The way I see the model is, I think what Tom was saying, that there are two distinct goals. There is a measurement of the liability, and it's quite right that that should be updated, change in assumptions, changes in discount rates, changes in risk margin, if that's your cup of tea. And there's another element to the premium that you receive on day one, and that is this element of the premium, this revenue, if you like, represents profit and compensation for all the things which aren't included in the liability measurement. And I think it's perfectly appropriate to remeasure that part of the premium that on day one you think is the insurance liability, and it is appropriate to run off and recognize as you perform under the contract that part of the premium which represents revenue. Effectively, it's like a revenue recognition approach for part of it, and it's a liability measurement, up-to-date liability measurement for the other part of it. I disagree with Pat and the analogy to bonds. I mean, bonds are different because bonds have contractual cash flows and you know what the cash flows are going to be. I think the whole point of insurance, you don't know what the cash flows are going to be, and that's why it should be unlocked, remeasured, and we have that up-to-date information. If we were to lock, then I see that there's a significant problem. So if we were to unlock, I see a significant problem because we have to define what is the portfolio that we have to unlock for. And depending upon how you define that portfolio, you get very different answers. If you unlock at the individual contract level, you effectively recognize all the losses on the contracts that you expect to pay out or going worse, and you don't recognize any gain on the rest. So, and the bigger the portfolio you do this to, the less prudent the answer becomes. And so it strikes me that there's a real sort of difficulty in achieving this through defining the portfolio. And now I know there's something in here about what that portfolio would be, but to my mind, it would have to be very, very sort of clearly articulated in order to get any degree of comparability. So I think the most appropriate approach is to lock in and do as Tom said, to follow the two different aspects, two different objectives that we have within the model.
Steve? Ilka?
I think Warren and Daryl, or to some extent also Pat, articulated the two extreme. And for me, there are only two options. Either we decide that we want to show a profit on day one, and then we have a current measure of the cash outflows. We have the discounting, we have the risk margin, and all of this gets a moot point because there is no residual margin. Or we have to face that to make the measurement meaningful, you have to consider you lock in, you assume profitability on day one, and then any changes in your assumptions going forward need, well, you can't run them through P&L and at the same time leave your assumed day one profitability being unwound on a pro rata or whatever basis, because you would get a fairly meaningless combined liability measurement. You have in an amortization of assumed day one profits, you have all changes in between going through P&L, and I'm wondering how to explain then my overall liability. It's current plus amortization of assumed day one losses, or gain, sorry. I think it becomes anyhow a moot point for short-term business if we stick to the coverage period, because then we are talking about a one-year period, and we're not talking about the settlement period as it's within the combined margin ideas. We have the problem, on the other hand, that this is highly linked to the discussion we still have to have on how to really measure the liability, how to consider the assets, so how to consider or not to consider OCI in. So there's a lot of linked to this, but I think what Andrea said is true. Either we decide upon day one profit, or we realize that we need to unlock the residual margin on day one to reflect changes in profitability, because we are locking in profitability, nothing else.
Leslie?
I won't repeat a lot of what's been said, but I agree with everything Steve said and everybody else's points that he incorporated by reference. The only other thing I wanted to mention was that I don't agree that you either have to recognize the gain up front or pursue a model like this. I think to recognize the gain up front before any of the risk has been released is inappropriate. And so we're forced into, I think, something similar to a revenue recognition model for that piece. Because the profitability overall will be limited to the difference between what you got the customer to pay you and what these cash flows end up being. And to Steve's point, that's the issue here. We don't know them. They're highly uncertain. So we have to do our best to find the pattern there. I find this approach a little bit too reminiscent of the corridor approach in pension accounting. And I know it's not a great analogy, but you know, Jennifer was saying that it has the effect of locking in the assumptions unless you go outside the corridor, you know, unless you blow through the residual. And I just, when you add together all of the elements of this that we don't expect it to be that big, et cetera, why add this complexity and why really take away the key benefit that at least we are trying to achieve, which is to have a current measure and show the effects of the changes in estimates currently?
Thanks, Leslie. Amaro?
Thanks, Dave. I'm not repeating. I was feeling uncomfortable with not having this current measure flowing through P&L, and I think this will add significant complexity to the model. I agree with the words already expressed by Warren, Tom, Stephen, and Leslie. I was pretty much uncomfortable additionally with the inconsistency with the revenue recognition model if we were going through the path that John or at some point with some mention of recognized day one. Again, in this project is even worse than in revenue reg under my view. That said, I have one question to the staff regarding the paper itself. You mentioned the paper, the reaction from the insurance working group and the field testing. But do you have any sense about the user's view, or you are considering the user's view as reflected in the insurance working group?
Well, there are users in the insurance working group as well, and the ones I've talked to have similar problems as that Patton has mentioned, that you need to explain a loss or a gain you have today that you already know that has an effect on you on the future release of the residual margin. And I would say the ones I heard is that they would favor the unlocking.
Only the ones in the insurance working group. We didn't outreach other users out of the insurance working group. This is.
But maybe
we haven't. I mean, I think that a lot of what we heard was focused on unlocking. I mean, exactly what was said was that how can I have this profit that's out there and take a loss today? Why would I not unlock it going forward? However, now we've introduced something that probably hasn't been discussed as much with the users of. Well, if I unlocked it and was obvious to the users that I changed my estimates and therefore I'm releasing some of the residual margin and letting them know that versus taking it down and putting it up and including the discount rate in there, that probably hasn't been explicitly talked about, at least from our end, with the users. Most of the users in and outside of the working group has been more on, do you take it down or do you leave it?
I mean, perhaps Warren could comment, because I believe this is very similar to the margin on services approach, and I've not heard that there've been any difficulties in Australia.
It's been in place for a long time, and it's a floating model, and it seems to work well, and it's understood. I don't think I agreed with it when we did it in Australia, to be quite honest.
Sure, Mark.
Sure.
Amaro, what I've heard over the last couple of months as users have talked to me, and I can't believe we've gone 45 minutes without using the word volatility. but that's what users have many have complained about, at least that I've heard. At the same time, to Pat's point and what Jennifer's point is, they're also trying to understand the changes in the effects of the changes in estimates. So I don't know that they've gotten a view on the specific accounting question of do you unlock a residual margin, but I think there's competing objectives of what they're trying to understand and how it gets reflected. So I don't know how helpful that is. But.
And what about you, Mark?
Well, I didn't want to repeat. I didn't want to jump in. I mean, this is not we don't have the risk residual margin in our model, but as long as I've got the microphone, I agree with what Warren and Leslie and Steve and Tom have said. Every time over the last couple of years that I've talked about trying to analogize to revenue recognition, I've been stopped to say this is about liability measurement until such time as volatility springs up, and now we want to talk about how it's actually going to be reflected in the profits, and let's deal with the volatility by unlocking the residual margin. I don't agree with that. I think that... I do think that it's a consequence of where we are on the day one gain issue. However, I think that to not reflect what's going on in the performance statement with the changes in estimates is not representative of what's happening in the economics.
Thank you. Tatsumi, you wanted to come in again?
Oh, sorry. Still, I need to learn something.
It is not a gun.
To learn how to use it, okay. I do not support unlocking. I keep carefully reading this one, and also I carefully heard the discussion today, so it's not convincing. I think your characterization of the residual margin as showing the current profitability, to some extent, such factor is in, but I put more emphasis on sort of this difference include some overhead cost, which is not included in the calculation of the building blocks. So I do not agree with unlocking, so unfortunately, I do not support what staff is proposing.
Okay, I've got Tom and PK.
It would seem if this was really about volatility, I would have expected the staff to say that the risk margin should be buffered against the residual margin. So why buffer just the change in cost against the residual margin? Why not buffer the change in the risk margin? Besides, because what you're doing is you're still having some of the change going through income and other of the change being buffered. I don't know how that really helps with volatility overall, because either you've got assets that are at amortized cost, you're still remeasuring some, not buffering at all, or if it's at fair value and you're buffering stuff where you're remeasuring the assets. I don't see how that deals with volatility.
No, Tom, can I just quickly, this is not about volatility. And I'm sorry, I'm repeating myself here, but this is about having a current measurement of the expected cash flows, a current measurement of the risk adjustment, a current measure of the appropriate discount rate. It's just where to adjust it for. But this is about the current measure. So, and what we also don't want to see is that actual experience that you have in that period that needs to flow through P&L. And we come to that later, why the changes in risk adjustment are more something like a current assessment of the current risk in that contract. It is more similar to a current experience than something that changes your estimate.
And just to add to what Sandra, sorry.
It seemed like it was about volatility when you come with your recommendation in the next memo about if the discount rate change creates volatility, do it or don't it. So, I mean, it seemed like there was some volatility in there.
I think it's fair to say that some of the comment letters that proposed this sought as one of the ways of dealing with the volatility, that wasn't the reason that we went down this path. I think if it's just about volatility, there are more obvious ways to try and deal with that in the presentation. I think the biggest convincing factor in it is about these counterintuitive effects is the inconsistency with day one measurement, that you use the estimates to estimate something on day one. On day two, your estimates may change, but still it's locked in on day one, and that's the driver for this paper rather than for the volatility.
So I think it has something to do with profit issues, and I would assert if we really were worried about profit mostly, the composite margin approach is the way to deal with profit well.
And it's the profit, I think the thing is that it's the profit for the non-insurance services. It's the idea that you've got the risk bit which you can measure, and then you've got the other bits which you don't know how to remeasure, and it's about trying to get that to be more current. That's the driver.
One other complication I wanted to raise if you do unlock. Think about what we are doing with acquisition costs. Most of them are thought to be assets amortized over time. In this model, if we accept that. In this model, we sort of embedded them into a negative liability, so it was sort of an asset sort of thing, and their effect was on the residual, and if you ran them off over time, the amortization, the acquisition costs would be recognized over time like you would in amortizing an asset. Now, if what you do is unlock the margin, and the residual margin is lowered by the acquisition costs, but then start changing the timing of how you recognize the residual margin, the effect is that you're going to amortize the acquisition costs or the effect of the acquisition costs in some perturbed fashion that has nothing to do with sort of over time, but about however the buffering works. And I think that challenges the thoughts of putting acquisition costs in the model too.
Just to get a clarity, I don't know what is the sanctity of day one locking a number which is prone to so many changes. So for that reason, I got persuaded that, you know, if you are going to go down the risk residual margin route, unlocking makes sense to me. But I want to ask staff a question. If the board goes to not to unlock residual margin, in your outreach, do the proponents who ask for unlocking, would they go for a composite margin, or would they go, what would be their linking? I know that I'm in favor of composite margin, but that's not the reason I'm asking. But I'm just trying to find out what happens. Is it such a big issue? That's why I asked the initial question, how big is the number we are talking with?
Well, I can give you an answer from my point of view, and maybe Jennifer has something to add. To agree with locking in residual margin has nothing to do with being a proponent of a composite margin. So if the board stays with locking in the residual margin, those people I've talked to wouldn't go to a composite margin because they still think that a risk adjustment does make sense and they want to show that information.
I'd say that we'd have to see. I mean, we will be bringing back to the boards we plan in July how the calculation of the risk adjustment on that side, and also more details on the calculation of the composite margin. And as we explained at the last meeting, you know, some of the staff view it as profit at risk, so it is being ran off over sort of this risk as your distribution becomes less narrow. And so the result, we would have to run numbers and the results to see where companies would fall out, I think, once they fully understand both models.
PK, you've mentioned the size of the residual margin a couple of times, I think, and I think it depends on the different product types. For it's biggest for the very long duration life type contracts, and as far as we can make out, it's likely to be fairly significant. If you think about it, if you were to characterize it as the expected profitability over 30 years, it's going to be significant. It's not a small number that we're talking about.
Yeah, I like to say why I think I support the staff recommendation. Number one, we are accounting for an insurance contract, not only for an insurance liability. Is that correct? Right. I sign a contract, it is assumed to be profitable. I have all my estimates, my risk margin, my residual margin, it's a profitable contract. I report no profit on day one. I defer my profit. Day two, some conditions change, and my contract may become a little bit less or a little bit more profitable. It is still profitable. It is not onerous. And it will change every day until the last day of the insurance coverage. And to report a profit or loss in each period for any tiny variation in the estimated profitability of the contract seems to be a bit counterintuitive. It's okay if you have eaten up all your profit on day one because you have reported a profit, and then any adjustment will become an extra profit or a loss. But if you have not reported profit on day one, which is the current assumption, it seems to me quite odd to report losses when you still have accumulated profit to recognize. So I think everyone who would report such a loss would say, but, however, I still have that accumulated profit which has not been released. So the problem we have is how to combine this notion of intuitiveness with the information value in the fact that the residual profit will be a little bit less or a little bit more because of changes in conditions. How to disclose the effect of changes in estimates on this residual profit? And I think users have told us they are interested to know the impact of changes in conditions. I'm not sure they have told us we want to see a loss or a profit recognized for that. So I think that is our difficulty. And the staff, I think, is not discussing how we could find a way to inform users without reporting necessarily a loss when the contract is not onerous. So maybe there is some more work to be done on how to report the effect of those changes in condition and how the adjustment to the margin will be disclosed when reported.
Mark, do you want to come in again?
As I listen to the points about the competing objectives between the day one recognize no gain issue and the current measurement of the liability, I'm brought back to thinking about the supplemental document where we had two competing models and we tried to smush them together. I know we're going to talk about presentation on the income statement later today or this week, but I just wanted to raise a thought while I had it about presentation on the balance sheet, that if we're really trying to think about having these two different models or these two different objectives, that a possible presentation approach for you to think about is to have the residual margin separated out on the balance sheet. In this way, you would have the liability measurement incorporate what you think is the true current liability measurement, whether we lock or unlock. And the day one gains, the residual margin broken out separately to run off on the balance sheet. And just leave it at that to try to settle the two competing objectives.
I think we'd have it in the rule forwards already.
I know.
But in the balance sheet as well.
We have two competing objectives here. And we're talking about the transparency behind both. I'm not thinking that a roll forward is the way to solve it. I'm thinking that you might want to consider in the presentation of the balance sheet the two separated out, yeah. Just to think about.
And something else over here, John?
Question. While you say this about volatility, the effect of what you're doing reduces volatility in earnings. Clearly, we've gotten a lot of feedback from constituents that that's a concern. If you were to do this, we were to do this, is that going to be responsive to their concern? Or are they still going to be concerned about volatility? And to me, if that's the issue and they're still concerned, I'm not sure this is worth the bang for the buck. And it seems to me that PK's point earlier, the more we put in here, the less cushion there is, if you will, to reduce volatility. So I'm just not sure, and it may be that we have conflicting views as to what this is going to accomplish. But to add, and I think there are a lot of operational issues here, to add this and find out that it's not satisfying the real concern, to me doesn't make a lot of sense. Any ideas on that?
Well, I think Philippe has said, I think, everything, that it has an effect on volatility because changes wouldn't flow immediately through profit and loss. It does have an effect, but that wasn't the objective of doing it, but it would solve some of the problem.
I think it depends on the whole thing with discount rate, because just based on this paper, you know, if we think about a 10 basis point movement in the discount rate, I can wipe out my entire residual margin and go below just with the change in discount rate, and so then I'd be reflecting some of it as an offset to the residual margin, some of it for that amount below. And so some of the preparers have already said, I hope OCI might not be off the table just because you're putting this now if this goes in residual margin. So it wouldn't fully, I think, solve some of those issues. And I think that's one of the concerns if discount rate is in here, because then the next day I can have a 15 basis point movement and swing the residual and reestablish the residual margin, that I can then have my changes in my true economics of the underlying, so my true assumptions of how my product is working, you know, go, you know, sort of be masked by the changes. So that's one of the questions that's sort of in a later paper, is if you were to unlock, do you use the discount rate as part of this? So not to sort of jump ahead or jump back, but I think the volatility issue is part of what you include.
Just to add to what Jennifer says, I think it, from what I can gather, it probably won't solve the volatility issue, and we would want to still see presentation solutions for volatility. This is not going to be the holy grail of volatility. I was saying this is not going to solve the volatility issue on its own. It might contribute to making it less of an effect, but it's not going to solve it, and they will still be wanting to look at presentation options. I think it's also fair to say if it was just about solving for volatility, I don't think we'd be recommending this. So.
Okay, we're going to have to pull to a close. Warren and then Pat.
Jennifer, Andrea, and John covered my point.
Okay, thank you. Pat?
I was just going to say, in light of John's question and Elka's observation, I found it difficult to answer this question until we've dealt decisively with the issue of accounting for the discount rate. I don't think this deals effectively unless you're going to run changes in the discount rate through it, but even then, if we do, I'm not sure it's sending the right signals. My experience has been that investors and analysts would like to see the volatility of non-financial variables flow through P&L, but they do not want to see the effects of financial variables flowing through P&L, where you know, the business is based on a long-term investment performance, i.e. life insurance. So I would say that we can take a tentative vote here, but I think it's really subject to what we do with respect to whether or not we present changes in interest rates related to assets and liabilities outside of income, because in my mind would inform my view or vote here. If we do that, then I would have an entirely different view on how to account for the residual margin. In which case, I might say don't unlock.
So just to clarify, you said the non-financial inputs maybe not in P&L.
No. What I'm saying is most investors and analysts, based on my experience, would like to see changes in non-financial variables flow through P&L currently, okay, as well as changes in future estimates of those variables, okay. But they prefer not to see changes, both current as well as future estimates and financial variables flow through P&L, because they think this is a business that is delivered over a long period of time. That kind of noise distorts the true performance. So I think we're kind of mixing apples and oranges here with this issue. I actually think we shouldn't take a vote, and we should defer the outcome until we finally resolve what we're going on.
We're taking a vote, Bob, yes.
Discount rate.
I think it's a bit chicken and egg in a way.
You're opening up nine.
Oh, that's out of order.
The mic was up before I could answer.
I think it's a bit chicken and egg in a way, Pat, in some ways, because I think to know what you're reporting, what you're presenting, you need to know what the change in liability is, and to know that as you need to know what you think the liability is in the first place. So we do need to look at them together, and we need to reconcile at the end, but sooner or later you're going to have to make one decision before you make the other decision, just because of life.
Okay. Sandra, I'm sorry, I usually agree with you, but I don't on this occasion, I'm afraid. I do agree. I like the idea of seeing the changes in the estimates. Tom made a very good point. You're clearly having a good day, Tom.
you know, about the... one out of a thousand.
You know, I thought that idea, the matching, was interesting. I hadn't thought of that, that you could actually have a distortion because of this, with the assets going in one direction and this going in a different one. So I don't agree with that. I most certainly do not agree with the day one gain. It might be my Calvinist upbringing, but the thought of someone having 30-year estimates and taking a gain up front without doing anything, I don't think I could take that. So I don't agree with this, I'm afraid. Okay, can we have a vote? We'll do ISB first, if we may. I'll put the staff recommendation, which is that we should unlock. Okay, those in favour? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, that's the majority. We better just check the ones who disagreed.
6, 7.
Okay.
Did you vote for? Mm-hmm. You voted for, thanks.
Okay. FASB, those who agree with the staff recommendation?
How can they vote? They don't want to support it.
Zero. Those who disagree, presume there's 7. Yeah. Anyone abstain? Yeah. Disagree? We just want to know where they are. Ask Leslie about that. They want to know where FASB stood if they should unlock.
We are planning to ask a question about the whole alternative model. So.
No, but Leslie.
If they were to have a residual, then would you unlock?
Yeah. Okay, well, I thought we might not have to look at question C, but I think we'll have to now.
Okay, thank you, David. So that's to confirm we need to look at 3C.
and that might change, hopefully, or in one way or the other, to confirm your decision you've just taken, if you want to unlock the residual margin, if you want to follow the recommendation in this paper. So this paper clearly recommends that changes in estimates should adjust the residual margin. That again means that current and actual experience should flow through P&L. Okay, the first issue we need to look at if we want to consume or float the residual margin. That's 3C, paper 3C. Okay, first question, consume or float. Consume would mean that you have unfavorable changes in your estimates. So they're not good, they're bad. You would buffer them in the residual margin. But if they are good changes, favorable changes, you would have an immediate gain. So the staff thinks this is a skewed presentation. So you should show both favorable and unfavorable changes in estimates. And so that would mean in this wording, load the residual margin. When we do this, we also have to look at, should there be a cap for favorable changes? I mean, you have a lot of favorable changes. Should the residual margin only be as much as you, well, determined at inception, or can it be more? And the staff would say, well, there is no obvious reason why a contract could not be more profitable than you decided at inception. So we don't see a reason for a cap. And this is question one, page five.
Philippe?
First, a question of consistency. Day one, no profit. Day one plus 1 minute, profit. No limits. It's a bit strange, the notion of no day one profit.
Which is for floating.
Yeah, if you float, assuming you float, and no limits on top of that, no cap. Seems to me that if you have one decision which is the day one, I sign a contract and have no day one profit, but the first reporting period, which is a quarter ending after the signature, 5 days, my quarter ends 5 days after I sign the contract. And then I have an adjustment, estimates, and then I can have a profit under this proposal, I float, no limits, so I can recognize a profit 5 days after I've signed the contract. Seems to me, it's a bit theoretical, but it could happen. And I don't think it's very consistent with this notion of day one, no day one profit. No, is there some?
Taking it into the margin, and you're not showing it as a
profit. The cap is only if you use floating. If you would consume the residual margin, and you would show favorable changes immediately in profit or loss. But you would run off the residual margin if there's no unfavorable change.
Just to clarify, I think my understanding of your proposal is exactly to avoid Philippe's observation, to make sure that if you have changed your assumptions on day two, that this is not immediately to be shown as a profit, but in that case would consequently change your increase your residual margin and be unwound over the remaining period. If you have an unfavorable change, same holds true, declining.
Okay.
And I think that's the only way forward to avoid that you start on day one with a profit, and on day two you get either excessively prudent or excessively excited about your business.
Is that you, John?
I'm back to where I started before. Paragraph 11, as I understand it, you would reverse a gain to the extent it doesn't exceed previously recognized expense, and then you'd reconstitute the residual. And to me, that would all involve tracking, which in paragraph 29, when you talk about retrospective or prospective, you recommend prospective because you can't track. So are you being inconsistent in the recommendations, or is there some way that you can do this one and not the other?
Well, it's not saying we cannot track. just saying it's very complicated. But yes, I mean, it's just if you have a change in estimate in one period, and that's extreme, and it would give you put you in an onerous contract position. So of course you would wipe out, as Jennifer said, the entire residual margin, and on top of that you would have an expense to go to the profit or loss. 2 periods after, in a 30-year contract, you see, well, that was just wrong. It's not my current estimate. And my current estimate would be, no, it is back to the favorable one, and you would still have some residual margin. So first of all, you would say, well, that expense that I've accounted for in 2 periods beforehand, that needs to be changed. It was an expense, now I have a gain, just to cover that initial expense. And on top of that, it will go back to the floating of the residual margin and would restate the residual margin here previously.
So somehow you would have to track this in order to do it. And I guess Stephen had a question earlier, to what extent is this going to be affected by the way we define portfolio? Is that,
of course,
a complicating, uncomplicating factor?
Of course, we need to look at portfolio as a cross-cutting issue, because it also has an effect on your onerous contract test. It has an effect on, well, how you determine cash flows and anything else.
Can I just ask, the way you're talking about reconstituting the margin, if you wouldn't allow it to increase beyond what it was in day one, would you?
Yeah, yes, we would.
You would?
Yes. Because if you had a different estimate on day one that happened to be higher, that would have been you. That's Elka's point.
That's the point Elka made, yeah.
Yes, it's otherwise it's nonsense.
Piki?
I think John touched on that point that I was about to bring up. It is getting very complicated. I appreciate that. The question that was asked, that I wanted to ask, which was touched by John, was that how do you define this portfolio? Are you going to freeze the portfolio? Because, you know, the whole discussion we had in the open portfolios in the financial instruments would come right back at it in a big time. And it's almost like you're telling, once you put a portfolio, you're stuck with that portfolio till it completely winds down. And I don't have enough practical experience to know in reality whether insurers do it that way. But I think this whole thing is predicated on that notion. And this open portfolio issue is coming back to haunt us one more time at a different place. And so I'm a little confused with the favorable changes and doing the true up and the inconsistency between para 11 and 29. I also have the same point. So I'm getting worried. But I still like unlocking, but I'm worried how to do that.
You only need one vote.
Yeah,
you only need one more vote, then we're done.
Let's see.
PK, on the question of the portfolio, PK. On the question of portfolio, we do need to look at the definition of the portfolio. There were some concerns in the comment letters about how we defined it in the exposure draft, and that is on our radar, so we do need to come back to that. The proposal here is for an open portfolio. It's similar to the method that's used in Australia for the margin and services, and we'd expect that we'd work in broadly a similar sort of way.
I think people have got to speak right into their microphones. Okay. People are turning sideways and talking, and that's part of the problem.
Sorry, Anne.
Well, I think the feasibility of tracking, at least we have that Australian experience, and they say they can do it, and that's
I think at the way that this is while we still need to define portfolio and what different types of, maybe for lack of a better term, products, lines of business you would group together, this would have it, to Andrea's point, be an open portfolio that it wouldn't be on the cohort level. So as I write new business, it would come into here. So it would be an open portfolio of additional amounts that would be in here. And then the question of the gains and losses is, while you might want to defer, you have gains that might be coming through because of something happened in the current year, the question arises of what's a true economic change versus just a change in assumption. So if we go back a couple of years from now, when everyone was up in arms over the bird flu and that people were going to get sick and have you know, major health issues and die early, then everybody took that assumption down to say, you know, that was probably a true economic change, not just a change, you know, in estimates going forward. Something changed in the current period. So how do you do that with an open portfolio of writing more business that goes into there?
Could I clarify something?
I thought the person from Australia that did the education session said that on the long-term stuff they did composite. Did I get that wrong? So I'm not sure that
that is correct.
That your analogy to Australia does it will work in
but
the composite.
That is correct, but what the Australians are also telling me that you can have a risk adjustment in that model. It doesn't affect the unlocking of the residual margin.
You simply have a piece of it rather than the whole of it.
So that's not something they do now.
It's not something they do now.
Wego, you were trying to come in?
Yeah, I wish we start from proposal, you know. If we agree with the original questions, I think naturally I will agree both favorable and unfavorable. And with the cap, that is the residual margin should not be below zero. Agree with
floor.
That would floor, yes, floor.
Tatsumi?
Just can I ask a quick question? So you said the purpose of the unlocking is to have a current profitability. So if we stick to that notion, how do you justify the sort of two consumption notion?
Well, the staff proposal, the recommendation is to float.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And you mean that the residual margin should not become negative. It should not become negative because on day one, if you would have a day one loss, you would recognize.
No, my point is, why consumption notion can be justified under your own thinking?
I think it cannot.
Okay, but why you ask the question?
So are you? So Tatsumi, are you saying that I would only increase the residual margin, but I wouldn't take it down? Because assuming
I thought the logical thinking is just a two float.
So you think the staff recommendation is logical thinking?
Yes.
That's good.
I do not agree with the unlocking.
Yeah, but having done that, then
thank you.
Thank you.
Hey, Steve.
Can I just clarify, you mentioned open portfolios. You would apply this floating to an open portfolio, however we define it. Because it seems to me that, isn't there a great danger that you have an old cohort of policies which is now loss-making, and those losses are hidden by the new residual margin you're booking on the new elements in that portfolio? I mean, how is that going to be transparent?
Stephen, I think that's absolutely, that's a danger. And we talk about this in Agenda Paper 3D, when we talk about allocation, and if we should use an aggregate level to determine the residual margin.
So what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, it's a decision you need to make. I mean, for the ED, we set a cohort level, and that was a closed portfolio in a way. It was the contracts within a portfolio that have similar coverage period and have similar starting point, that is something close to a closed portfolio, or if you should use a individual contract level to determine the residual margin, or if you want to have an aggregate level.
But is closed portfolio operational?
It is not. This is explained in the
agenda paper. So it has to be open portfolio, so therefore the problem I just outlined will be present.
So it needs some limits or discipline, what contracts you put together in for aggregation to determine the residual margin.
Well, I agree there needs to be discipline about the breadth of a portfolio, but what about the changes over time? That there wouldn't be any, how would you limit that other than by going to the cohort level?
I think for an operational, I think companies would need to look at how closed of a portfolio, what the cohort level. Companies today do track when their contracts are written and the underwriting year, the accident year, they track that. So I think it would be how difficult or, you know, how much extra work to do it at that level. I wouldn't say that it's not operational to do it at that level because they are tracking the underwriting year and the accident year in almost every insurance company.
Warren? Well, I would limit this, you might expect. I would make it as least complex as we could. That's probably not correct English, but you know what I mean. So it would only be for unfavourable changes, and it would be seeking to deal with the counterintuitive effects that people have pointed out, that we haven't allowed day one gain, but you would require any adverse experience to be recognised immediately in income, and you're just running the gain off over time. So I would limit it to those unfavourable changes in estimates only, and they would be non-financial. I know you're going to get to that.
Warren.
You may say that's not logical, but I don't agree with the decision.
Not logical.
I understand the logic. I just don't agree with the outcome.
Warren, I think this will naturally add more complexities. You have to trace all of the each cash flow to see whether this was favorable, another one is unfavorable.
Now you change the portfolio, you're done. You can play the game.
So you have to trace all of the individual cash flow to see and compare the original expectations and the current expectations, whether it is favorable or non-favorable, and then if it is favorable, you would do this way. If it not, do another way. It would be more complicated, which you don't like.
Yeah. Okay, any more comments?
Is this a bit of a moving target?
It is.
In that, if we know what we're talking about with portfolio, we know what the mechanics are, or what the hurdles are with this. And so it just seems like this is coming ahead of what we should be talking about.
But I'm not sure that whether it goes up and down really depends on whether the portfolio is open or closed, does it?
I was thinking open, closed make a huge difference.
It does.
And how you define it would enter into it.
Absolutely, but I think we'll come to that if you
have patience.
Let's just get through the
people. I think that the favorable, unfavorable, so to your point, I mean, I'm making the adjustments not on a contract basis. I'm making it on whatever, a line of business. So I'm either saying my mortality is worse or better. So it's not that I'm tracking each individual, change of favorable and unfavorable. I'm looking at my 8 assumptions and whether there's movements and if it's a favorable or an unfavorable adjustment. I'm not sure if that adds complexity to it or not. You would know which way you're moving your mortality, morbidity, lapse rate assumptions.
To follow on to that, so if you're not floating, so if you have a favorable change one period, that would go to P&L, is that correct? Mm-hmm. And then the next period you have an unfavorable change in the same variable, that would go to the residual, even though the favorable change went to P&L.
Exactly.
And then, so wouldn't you have to keep track of, the first time you have a favorable change, so you've got them in P&L, and the unfavorable changes aren't going through P&L, so you're not recognizing unfavorable changes. You're deferring unfavorable changes but recognizing favorable changes, and to me, that doesn't seem like good accounting.
Yes.
That's partly why I don't think it depends on whether it's an open or closed portfolio. It's just, sort of, like Sumi says, it's just logical.
But once you unlock, this is a consequence of it. Are you going to do that? And if you do that, how do you track it?
this issue comes up in the open portfolio.
It also comes up in the closed
portfolio. Pat, I didn't say that my approach was logical. I think the staff's approach is logical. But what is it that you're trying to achieve? And I think they're trying to give some meaning to this residual margin as some sort of profit that's being recognised over time, and that, you know, if you have changes in assumptions, that'll change that measure. So you have, that makes the whole measure of the liability more understandable. I don't buy that, frankly, because I just think it is a day one gain that you haven't recognised for the reasons, you know, David's Calvinist upbringing. Other people have other reasons why you don't do that. And you're going to recognise at some point it's fairly arbitrary. And I think constituents have said, well, if you're not going to allow us to recognise it on day one, it's not very fair. If we have a big loss, say, in the first period, and you've got all this locked away, surely we can offset that. So it's where you're coming from, how you actually, I think, analyse and attribute some meaning to what it is you're trying to deal with. And I don't really buy the staff's rationale. I don't see it in that way. So the logic that worries you doesn't concern me. You'll have a different objective.
Because you voted against this in the first place.
Okay, well, if one of the ISB 8 wants to change their vote from the last, just let me know any time.
Okay, we better put the staff recommendation. Could I take A first? Favourable, unfavourable changes? Those in favour, ISB?
10, 11. Okay.
And you want this completely unlimited as well, I presume?
Oh, yeah.
Anyone disagree with that? I disagree with it. Yeah.
You're
going
to be here. 11 in favour of the staff recommendation. 11 in favour of the staff recommendation.
And the second question, B, those in favour?
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. 11 again.
Oh, may the Lord have mercy on your souls. That's right.
Does it count? Can we get the who's again?
This is time to go, fellas. It really is.
Okay, Fabian.
And then we need to vote.
Yeah, we're going to pass on this one.
Does ISG want to pass on this one as well? Okay, question two. What more damage can you do now? Right.
Okay, let's have a quick look at question two. I've always said that we want to adjust the residual margin for now the favorable and unfavorable changes in estimates. So this is what you estimate about the future. These are like changes in your estimates about mortality, morbidity, and so on. And first of all, we look here at changes in estimates of cash flows. And I just ask you if you agree with the staff recommendation that you only adjust for estimates, and here estimates and cash flows.
You're expressing dismay at the last vote, but this is based on the understanding that the board is supporting unlocking. So if you're stuck with having to unlock, the question is how you're going to do it. Okay.
Yeah, exactly.
So those people who didn't raise their hand, I guess they're just saying,
don't care what you do.
They don't care because they didn't support. What's that?
I voted against. I care.
I voted against it too, but now that you are outvoted there, the question becomes, how should you do it?
Given that you're going to do it.
That's all I was trying to make a point of. Right? So, okay.
Okay.
What's that? Well, I just want to clarify that.
Now we know how much you care.
Question two. Any comments?
Okay. Those changes in estimates, maybe I just quickly say something. We previously did always discuss estimates in financial, non-financial inputs. This is your changes in estimates in general, because first of all, we have the problem sometimes those changes in estimates do affect each other, like lapse rates and changes in interest rates. Those estimates are together. So what question two is really is, if changes in the estimates on cash flows are changing, do you want to adjust the residual margin?
So,
Steve?
So changes in discount rate, any change in the expected cash flow?
Change in discount rate is the next question.
Yes.
I think changes in, yeah, we should discuss the discount rate in the next one.
You're talking about the building block
cash flow.
One. Yes.
Yeah. We're just talking about building block one, right?
Let's look at each of the building blocks in turn.
Yeah.
Sorry, Steve first.
So the issue here is changes in estimates versus experience adjustments. So you're saying that experience goes through the income statement each year, changes in estimates, so forecasts don't. But then how do you define experience? Is experience for the quarter or the day or the year? So I've got daily reporting, there's experience for the day, and then everything else for the rest of the year is a change in estimate. If I report quarterly, experience is the quarter, and then there's change in estimate. What if I report every 2 years? Experience is now 2 years' worth. I don't see the conceptual difference between a change in cash flows that occurs in the current year and a change in the cash flow that I expect to occur next year. So why don't you unlock for experience as well?
Well, I think experience needs to be shown in the P&L because
which
this
experience, quarter or annual?
Well, reporting period. I think we always have the same problem with that because we have a reporting period and we normally don't define that.
But what's the conceptual reason for current period experience differing from a change in assumption for a future period?
So I think what this is trying to get at is, and there's an operational difficulty in this, it's not just for the period, it's for the future. So if I change my assumptions on July 1st, then anything before July 1st, from January 1st to June 30th, should be in my change in expectations. Anything from July 1st through the end of the year should be my change in assumptions, so no matter what period you're reporting in. But it is an operational difficulty because some companies change their assumptions in the third quarter and have it retro back to the beginning of the year some companies change their assumptions at the beginning of the year, some change at the end of the year. So it might cause, if this is the vote, it might, because you're treating experience and assumptions differently, it might cause us to have to bring back another question of when would you have to put in place your change in assumptions?
So I change my assumption on 30th of December, and that can be taken against the margin. I change my assumption on the 2nd of January. I can't now because that's now going to be experience.
Well, I think it has a different idea behind it, and I hope that Jennifer agrees with me. The assumptions we're talking about, like mortality, morbidity, you wouldn't change that every day. You would change it maybe once per year and so on. I think it is a difference in the idea what you want to show. Is it something that really occurred in this year in that period, or something that affects your 30-year contract expected profitability, what happens in the next 25 years, because I have a different assumption now. It's not, is my cash flow next year probably 100 higher because I expect something exactly in the next period. It's more about what happens, what I think, in the next 25 years.
That's PK feeling.
Philippe?
I'll come back to you, PK.
I think before I vote on question two, I would like to make sure I understand the interaction with question three. And question two, you say any change in estimate you unlock, including some financial variables in those estimates. But question three says that if it is discount rate, maybe there is a different treatment permitted. Now, it seems to me that some financial variables that will be covered in question two may be impacted by the changes in discount rate, or maybe correlated to the change in discount rate. So is there a risk of mismatch, of creating a mismatch by saying yes to question two and yes to question three? So I want to make sure I understand the full package before I make up my mind on those questions.
Philippe, I think your concern is we share your concerns in a way. I just think that some of these estimates we're talking about here, and there's probably non-financial inputs, when we talk about lapse rates, they will be affected by changes in interest rates, about your estimated changes in interest rates. And I just think it's hard to separate them, and it also depends on what you do, what you assess first, about second. So I think we could take those estimates together. And there might be the possibility that we create an accounting mismatch, but this is more pronounced in the second question, the changes in discount rate.
So just to add on, to not pile on, but try to add clarity to it, so if somebody has options and guarantees or has lapse rates, so obviously if the interest rates change, for the better, people are going to lapse. They're going to take their money and go invest elsewhere, right? So there is that risk, and I think there's a mixed view of, is that interest rate change impacting my ultimate amount I'll have to pay out, so my true expected, or is the interest rate change, if it's to the discount rate, not on these other variables, is that really just saying that's a non-economic change that is I'm going to have to still pay out, you know, $10 million, whether it be in 3 weeks from now, 10 years from now, 30 years from now, versus an interest rate change that actually affects the amount I'm going to have to pay out ultimately. And I think that's where the split comes. So this, you know, is really the change in the variables regardless of the interest rate changes.
Tom, are you trying to come in?
Clarified or confused it.
Figure out if this is going to mitigate or exacerbate a mismatch. It depends on what's going on the asset side. And if you've got some assets at fair value and some at amortized cost, you got a mixture of financial and non-financial variables either changing or not changing on your asset side. Moving into judgments as to whether some of these things exacerbate or mitigate mismatches is an impossibility. And if you pick up part of them, if you go to the discount rate and permit it, some of the times you can do it, some of the times you can't. It's an entity-wide election. It's for all your liability. It's for some of the portfolios. It's none. It's in certain periods. It's a lot of complexity, and I don't think you're going to achieve the reduction of volatility at an entity-wide level on any consistent basis.
Elka?
I think I agree with Philippe. I have a hard time on making up my mind today on question two and three without knowing how we go to deal with the potential mismatch or the interdependence between assets and liabilities first. On the other hand, I have sympathy for staff's idea to say any changes in your estimates about future cash flows can't be really separated between those that are financial and non-financial, because there's always a kind of a borderline in between. But I would suggest to really postpone questions two and three until we've dealt with how to measure assets and the link between assets and liabilities. Four is a different one. It's on risk margin, as far as I've kept it in mind.
Yes, good question. And maybe this is related to what Tom said. I simply don't understand how you could have an expectation that the amount that you've deferred as the residual margin could absorb potential volatility in changes in interest rates. In other words, when you priced the contract, you were expecting yields of a certain amount, but they aren't inherent in that premium, they're accounted for elsewhere in the accounting model. So while you might have a coincidental amount that's adequate to absorb the volatility, I just don't see how that's a viable solution to solving that problem.
But Leslie, could I just come back on that? I mean, a couple of people said we're trying to solve the volatility. We really are not trying to. It is the incidental benefit. We're not doing this
in order to solve the volatility. But so then can I understand why you're not ready to vote then? Because I thought I just heard you say you want to see how we deal with the assets, the mismatch. So maybe I misunderstood.
You've probably misunderstood my intention, why I wanted to postpone it. I'm not considering what we're discussing here to be a solution to the volatility issue. It's not. I would probably consider that I can vote on two subject. I'm not sure whether two is not too broad a wording, because there might be the one or the other issue which I would like to see in profit and loss, subject to how we decide upon asset and liability. On question three, I'm very concerned that we say that we want to permit it for certain, where was it? No, I think it was somewhere that we want to permit it for certain mismatches, which I haven't made up my mind whether we have a mismatch, which is depending on how do I measure my liability. So I think it's just too interlinked that I would like to say yes here, only to say no next week.
I think, Elka, to your point, there might not be a mismatch in profit or loss depending on where you are later, but then there would be a mismatch in OCI. If you are going to absorb changes in estimate into decision margin and you're not going to do that with the assets, which presumably you're not, then there's always going to be some kind of mismatch. I don't know where it is.
I would like to see the full
picture, I can understand,
and then to make a decision on what ends where instead of going piecemeal.
So
that was my only argument.
Yeah, and I could reformulate questions two and three in a way to say that in principle what we would do would be to recognize the effect of changes in estimates as an adjustment to residual margin.
And
subsequent
that's fine with
to
that.
A future decision about how you might want to mitigate the effects of any accounting mismatches.
I would be fine with that.
Any other comments?
Are we on three as well as two or what?
Seems like it.
A comment on three, it's similar to what I said before. It would seem to me that I don't know, it says permit to the extent as I read the words. That to me could mean some, all, some portion for some period of time, and depending on what you do, you can have a huge tracking problem. So whatever your recommendation is, I'd hope you would consider how to make it operational.
Yeah, and that's something we'd have to consider if we went down the OCI route as well. That's the same questions.
Yeah, I think we've seen it in the paper that it's really hard to say which assets would back up which liabilities and how to say, well, I do have an accounting mismatch here because my assets are exactly those. I think that's a problem.
Any other comments?
So it becomes a little bit more of a question of do you even want to unlock for discount rate changes also? Yeah.
I'm not quite sure. So the John's question is why it is permitted? No?
It was more of an observation that depending on how you define the mismatch, particularly if you define it to be some, not all, and for some period of time, not all, what happens when that portion isn't recognized and now you got a subsequent period and you're doing the same? Do you have to track that to find out whether you recognize it or not? It just seems that there's an operational issue they got to deal with. That's all.
Okay. My concern on this point is why you should allow. You should say requires, it seems to me. I'm not quite sure why.
I think the reasoning behind the allow was that we just think that there might be some circumstances where the complexity complexity of tracking it, you might rather just take it.
Oh, okay.
And I think it's just consistent with the way we thought about the same sort of mismatches when we talked about it in OCI and we carried that forward.
But if it is very difficult, why we have to care about this?
It depends how big it is for you. If it's small for you, you don't care. If it's big, then you might. It depends on your circumstances, where the cost benefit lies.
Right. But say, if we requires, same thing could be applied. Yeah. If it is not material,
mm-hmm.
It's not necessary to.
It's true.
I mean, I think that there's some concern that if you unlocked it through the residual margin for all changes in discount rate, that there's certain types of products out there, such as certain guarantees, so that that a company has a hedge, not to get into the derivatives thing, but you know, they basically buy assets to hedge against the movements in the guarantee, and that those assets they're actually managing to a fair value. So because of that, you would want to take the change in the discount rate for those the effect for the guarantees, the change in the discount rate on those through. So it depends on what type of product you're talking about. So if you're talking about certain products, like a guaranteed minimum, you know, accumulation benefit or withdrawal benefit, those are getting, you know, fair value through the P&L. I've got assets matching those. So I think that's what the concern here is to let companies match that, the discount rate up with where the assets are moving that I basically have a hedge on without calling it a true hedging.
But by
no such thing anymore.
But by allowing, so there's no guarantee for the comparability, I think.
I'm getting a bit concerned that we might just making random decisions, you know, in the sense that we have to be careful what we're jumping at. We want to see the whole picture now. The decision has been that you unlock. The question then is, what's experience? What is estimates? Which ones are you going to allow to be unlocked? You know, you've mentioned the cash flows. Now here comes an optional one on the discount rates. You've got the portfolio issue and the tracking. You know, even if you want to do this, can you? We can make these decisions just to get an indication for the staff, but I wouldn't see these, you know, as firm decisions. I think there are problems in, you know, real problems in here. Could I just get a quick estimate on 2 and 3, and we'll stop at that stage. 2, you know, who would think that this is something that should be agreed to? Question 2, who agrees with the staff recommendation, ISB?
2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9, 9
three.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight. Against three.
Against discount.
Two's carried, but we've got to be careful. This just isn't a random series of decisions. We need to sort of put the whole thing together and have a look at what's happening. And you have to deal, I think, with the operationality of it all.
We have the marketing services for that.
You've got the model, okay. Maybe come in July. Okay, can we stop for half an hour? We'll start again at 5:02.
I think eight. Yeah, I think it was eight against the rate change.
Yeah. Discount rate change. I mean, you're going to have a residual. We've got the thing here. Can you see the...